wish I knew how it would feel to be free. I wish I could break all the chains holding me. I wish I could say all the things that I should say.
You are listening to the Prison Voices Project, a radio storytelling project highlighting the voices of people impacted by the prison system. The Prison Voices Project airs on the second and fourth Thursday of every month from 10 to 11 a.m. on WGXC Hands On Community Radio 90.7 FM. If you are listening to the program and would like to share your story with the prison system, or you have ideas for the program, or you would like to get involved, please write to us at 704 Columbia Street, 2nd floor, Hudson, New York, 12534.
I wish I could give all I'm longing to give. I wish I could live like I'm longing to live. I wish I could do all the things that I can do, though I'm way overdue. I'd be stuck.
How does our society feel about sex offenders?
Well, they hate them. I mean, you see articles posted on someone committing a sexual offense. And I would challenge that most people don't even read the articles. But you see in the posts and comments below, which comments, you know, must always be taken with a grain of salt. But you see them saying, you know, these child rapists and molesters should be hung up by the, strung up and killed. And you see a very violent response to that. In general, you see in flesh, in person, when you find out that somebody is on the registry and you don't know a whole lot about them, you automatically see people clam up. You see people respond differently. The conversations around people on the registry are always with the premise that they are violent and they are a danger. And so society as a whole believes that if you're on a registry, you pose a danger and you are likely to reoffend.
Sex offenders are the lowest people on the totem pole, and I'd say probably in society. And they're really an easy target for politicians to gain political will. And I think that politicians take advantage of that and pass laws that are not based on reason and science, but are instead give them great talking points for campaigns. So there are so many aspects of the way that New York and the rest of our country treat people on the sex offender registry that are not grounded in science, and in many ways are actually counterproductive to preventing recidivism. But politicians do not have the political will or even the interest in trying to reform these laws.
Hello, I'm Alexandra Cox, and this is the Prison Voices Project. This week's show is about how we treat sex offenders in New York. I'm going to focus on a new policy that allows the New York State Department of Corrections and Community Services to hold people past their release date if they have been convicted of certain sex offenses and if they can't find housing outside of a school zone. States across the country impose various restrictions on the lives of sex offenders. Josh Gravens of the Texas-based organization Organize Justice explains what some of those restrictions are.
So registration is the mechanism that allows or that law enforcement uses to know a person who has committed a sexual offense. It's different across the states. The federal government in 2006, Congress passed and President George W. Bush signed into law the Adam Walsh Act, which was a part of it was SORNA, the Sex Offender Registration and Notification Act, which was designed to try to create and encourage a cohesive standard formula for how a person would register. Register being going into law enforcement and saying, here I am, I committed a sexual offense, I'm here to register. Public notification is what most people are familiar with. Public notification is actually the public registry that you can sign on and you can see the photographs and the offense and the address of someone who is publicly listed.
My name is Dr. Jill Levinson, and I'm an associate professor of social work at Barry University in Miami, Florida. I study the impact and effectiveness of policies designed to reduce recidivistic sexual violence. So most people are familiar with the law called Megan's Law, which allows states to publicize the whereabouts of sex offenders whose addresses are registered with local law enforcement agencies so that they can be tracked and followed. And the idea is that through sex offender registration, the whereabouts of known convicted sex offenders will help to protect children and to help parents and other vulnerable people make decisions that might protect them from sexual violence. So in 1995, the first residence restriction law was passed, actually in Florida, and originally it was a condition of probation. So any convicted sex offender on probation who had had a victim under the age of 18 was required to live at least 1,000 feet from schools, parks, playgrounds, daycare centers, and other places where children congregate. And in 2005, the first local ordinance was passed. And what that means is these are local laws passed by cities or towns or counties. And they were inspired in Miami Beach by the kinds of laws that prevented adult establishments from operating within 2,500 feet of a school. And they said, well, why isn't it that sex offenders are allowed to live within 2,500 feet of a school? And the first local ordinance was passed.
This is Alexandra Cox, and you're listening to the Prison Voices Project. In addition to possessing the residency restrictions described by our guests, Josh Gravens and Dr. Jill Levinson, in 2007, New York State joined 19 other states in allowing the civil confinement of sex offenders after they have finished their prison terms. Here, Senator Jeff Klein, one of the biggest proponents of restrictions for sex offenders in New York State, speaks in favor of the civil commitment bill before it was eventually passed and signed into law by Governor Eliot Spitzer.
Senator Klein, why do you rise?
Mr. President, I'd like the opportunity to explain my vote.
Senator Klein, to explain his vote.
I rise in support of this legislation, and I know there's been some changes since the last bill, which we passed on special session. And I certainly believe that the time is now to finally pass a civil confinement law in New York State. When we open up our newspapers, both our daily and our local newspapers, we constantly see localities across the state of New York trying to pass what I consider to be piecemeal laws. They're trying to ban level 2 and 3 sexual predators from living within 200 feet of a school, in essence, preventing these individuals from living anywhere in a city or town. That's not the answer. I think we're also seeing that Megan's Law is merely a Band-Aid approach after years of using that as a way to protect our children and our families from dangerous sexual predators. So I think it's important now that we finally pass civil confinement, because quite frankly, I think it's the only answer to make sure that someone is not released until they're ready to join society once again safely. I conducted a study last year where I looked at all the zip codes in the city of New York as well as Westchester County. And when looking at those zip codes, we found that on average, there was 7 level 3 sexual predators living in each of those zip codes. Just this past weekend, Congressman Anthony Weiner released a study which found that 85% of the level 2 and 3 sexual predators presently living in New York City are living within 5 blocks of a school. 38% are living within a block of a school. That's a serious problem. And I think what we're doing now is we're giving residents all over the state of New York a false sense of hope that they're actually safe from a violent sexual predator. When you look at the statistics, it becomes even more apparent that we need to pass this law. First, a level 3 sexual predator or a dangerous sexual predator is 4 times more likely to commit the same or similar crime when they're released from prison. It's also the only type of criminal where there's a greater propensity to commit this crime as they get older and over. So I'm hopeful that we'll quickly reconvene our conference committee, work out, I believe, the minor differences in the 2 pieces of legislation, and finally keep the residents, and especially our families of New York State, safe from violent sexual predators. I vote yes, Mr. President.
I spoke with 3 lawyers who represent people in post-conviction sex offender restriction proceedings. Here, Jill Sanders, Associate Appellate Counsel at the Center for Appellate Litigation, explains New York's Sex Offender Registration Act law.
The Sex Offender Registration Act is codified in Correction Law 168. There's many different rules with regards to what persons are required to register, what registration means, how to adjudicate them specific levels of risk of reoffense, and also what are their responsibilities in terms of reporting. I'm Lauren Stevens-Davidowitz, and I'm a senior staff attorney at the Office of the Appellate Defender. I direct our SORA project, and I also work on appeals and other post-conviction litigation for people who have been convicted of sex offenses, but also people who have been convicted of other felonies in Manhattan and the Bronx. There are 2 components to the Sex Offender Registration Act. There is community notification and there is registration. So everybody, in terms of registration, everybody needs to register with the police at regular intervals. For people who are level 1 and level 2 sex offenders, they have to register in person every 3 years with the police and by mail annually, unless their address changes, in which case they have to go in person to the police department within 10 days. They also need to register their email addresses and other screen names and that sort of thing. If they're a level 3 sex offender, they have to register in person every 90 days. So that's a much more onerous requirement and impedes on people's ability to get jobs and attend school. All of those restrictions and obligations are onerous on people, but I think that people really feel the effects of a sex offense conviction when they're on parole, because there are many, many, many parole restrictions that are applied to them that can make their lives very difficult. And the one that is the most problematic and that's statutorily mandated is that if you are a level 3 sex offender or if you have a crime that involved a child, no matter what your level, you can't, quote unquote, knowingly enter within 1,000 feet of a school. This substantially impacts people who are in a lower income bracket or someone who might be considered indigent, because the lack of affordable housing, particularly in the 5 boroughs of New York and most likely throughout the state, it's very difficult to find a place to live that is not within 1,000 feet of a school.
You're listening to the Prison Voices Project on WGXC. Today's show focuses on restrictions faced by people convicted of sex offenses after their conviction. Dr. Jill Levinson, an associate professor of social work at Barry University in Florida, describes the effects of residency restrictions on individuals who fall into this category.
So in densely populated areas, in some places,
we now have a problem of sex offender homelessness. So people can't find addresses that are compliant. They are unable to live with supportive relatives or family members. And they may also, coming out of prison, they may be underemployed. They may not have a lot of resources for security deposits and first month's rent. So for all criminals returning from incarceration, it's, you know, these are obstacles that they face. And so when they have friends or family willing to take them in, that really helps with the reentry transition. So that becomes something that is not an option for many sex offenders in densely populated metropolitan areas.
My name is Josh Gravens. I'm the executive director of Organized Justice. Well, my point of entry to activism was obviously that I grew up on the registry. From a very young age, you know, I was placed on the Texas Sex Offender Registry at age 13 for touching my younger sister, who was 8. And I entered a period of incarceration for 3.5 years in the Texas youth prison system. And then I was released and was kept on parole until age 21 and was publicly listed on the Texas Registry until 2012. And I am now privately listed. And so my life is very much affected by the policies that we have in place regarding people who are on the registry. The registry has probably impacted every aspect of my life. When I was released and released into high school, I attended school, and it was a place that I really liked being. I had been homeschooled before. So after being released from prison, when I was 17, the last 2 years of high school were the first time that I had ever been in a public school, and I really liked it. And I went through almost 2 years, no issues, and then finally 2 weeks from the end of senior year and 2 weeks before graduation, it came out that I was on the registry. And all of a sudden I had friends. I was the president of my of the senior class. I was on student council. I was in different academic groups and all sorts of clubs. And all of a sudden nobody wanted to be around me except for a close core of friends that really stuck it out. But I went from very popular to a pariah in a day. And then you go on, and I've lost jobs. I got into work, and I worked on wind farms, and then they found out I was on the registry, and I lost a career. And then I became a father, and I tried to provide housing for my kids, and I couldn't. And I tried to get a job so that multiple jobs so that I could provide for my family, and it just didn't happen. And my story is relatively simple, relatively straightforward, and it's not everybody's story. And so there are people who have had much greater impact on their lives from the registry and from registration, including physical harassment, harm, and death.
Be proud of who I am, but they won't let my secret go untold. I paid the debt I owed them, but they're still not satisfied. Now I'm a branded man out in the cold. When they let me out of prison, I held my head up high, determined I would rise above the shame. But no matter where I'm living, the black mark follows me. I'm branded with a number on my name. I'd like to hold my head up and be proud of who I am, but they won't let my secret go untold. I paid the debt I owed them, but they're still not satisfied. Now I'm a branded man out in the cold. If I live to be 100, I guess I'll never clear my name. 'Cause everybody knows I've been in jail. No matter where I'm living, I got to tell them where I've been, or they'll send me back to prison if I fail. I'd like to hold my head up and be proud of who I am, but they won't let my secret go untold. I pay the debt I owe them, but they're still not satisfied. Now I'm a branded man out in the cold. Now I'm a branded man out in the cold.
That was Branded Man by Merle Haggard. I spoke with Robert Newman, who's a lawyer at the Legal Aid Society in Manhattan, and he represents a number of individuals who've been affected by these laws. He talks about his roots into the work here and one of the first clients that he represented who faced such residency restrictions. He then goes on to talk about the genesis of a new policy in New York that was initiated in February of 2015.
Well, I have spent my career as a legal aid lawyer representing the underdog, in many cases, society's most despised people. And sex offenders nowadays are the most despised people in the criminal justice system. But my direct involvement in this issue of the residency restrictions came back in 2006 when a client was referred to me named Ariel Berlin, who was a 77-year-old man who had no criminal record whatsoever until he was 72 years old and he committed a sex offense. He touched a 5-year-old daughter of an acquaintance through her clothing. He was convicted. He did his time. He served 5 years in prison. And the day before he was to be released from prison, by this time he was 77 years old and disabled. He had a heart condition. He could barely walk. He was told that he would not be able to return to the apartment on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, where he had lived for his entire life almost, since he emigrated from Israel. He had lived there alone. He had lived there for approximately 40 years. All of his friends were in that same neighborhood. And he was told the day before his release that he would not be able to return to his apartment because it was within 1,000 feet of a school. It was about 5 blocks from a school. There was no way you could see the school from the apartment. But it was still like nearly all the rest of Manhattan within 1,000 feet of a school. And he was directed to move to a homeless shelter. And he spent the next 2 years shuttling back and forth between nursing homes and homeless shelters. I obtained a ruling from a Supreme Court justice in Manhattan in a case called Berlin versus Evans that applying this residency restriction law to him for a crime that occurred before the law was enacted was an ex post facto law and he should be able to return to his home. But the state obtained a stay of that decision and the client died in a homeless shelter while the case was still pending before the appellate division. He was never able to go home. Senator Jeff Klein from the Bronx heard from a constituent that sex offenders in his district were
residing, at least a few of them were residing within 1,000 feet of school grounds, which is prohibited under the law. This constituent was carefully following the statewide sex offender registry, which is on the internet. And Senator Klein then alerted the press to the fact that the Bellevue shelter, which is the intake shelter for the New York City shelter system, to which all single men must report when they seek shelter, is actually within 1,000 feet of school grounds. And in the face of a campaign by tabloids, the state decided that it would now enforce the residency restriction not only with respect to private residences, like my client Berlin's residence, but also with respect to homeless shelters, and would not release any sex offenders subject to the law who were being placed on parole or post-release supervision to the shelter system unless the shelter system could guarantee that the shelter was more than 1,000 feet from school grounds. And there are only a handful of New York City shelters that are more than 1,000 feet from school grounds. None of them are intake shelters. So because the shelter system could not make that guarantee, the state started keeping these individuals in prison beyond the maximum expiration date of their sentences, in addition to denying parole or conditional release to inmates who had otherwise qualified for parole or conditional release because of their good behavior in prison.
I asked Lauren Stevens Davidowitz of the Office of the Appellate Defender to explain a little bit more about what the parole sentencing structure is and what actually is meant by a maximum expiration date.
In New York, we have two types of sentences, indeterminate sentences and determinate sentences. A determinate sentence is 5 years. It's a flat number. Every determinate sentence in New York needs to be followed by a period of post-release supervision, which is basically exactly the same as parole. We have those types of sentences, and then there are also indeterminate sentences, for example, 6 to 12 years. That sentence has a minimum and a maximum. You can serve as few as 6 years and as many as 12 years, and the parole board can decide whether or not you can be released early or if you have to serve up until, and if you are released early, like let's say they release you after 6 years, then you have to serve the rest of that sentence on parole. And if you violate, then you can spend more time in prison, serving out that sentence in prison.
Jill Sanders of the Center for Appellate Litigation describes the case of one of her clients who have been affected by this new policy.
This case is, it's always one that I think of because I've spoken with this man so many times and I've really gotten to know him, and he's one of these people that was affected and he was held several months past his maximum release date. When he was in his later 20s, he engaged in a sexual relationship with a woman, a young lady who was 14 years old, and the young female in this case, she did consent to this contact, but under the laws of our state, she is not legally able to consent. And the client completely admits his guilt in this offense. He knows what he did was wrong. He knows that he shouldn't have done it. And he accepted responsibility for his offense. And he is somebody who, after our SORA hearing, he was adjudicated a level one offender, meaning considering all the things in his background, considering the facts of his offense, the judge in his case agreed that he's a low risk of ever reoffending. So this client of mine, he was an excellent inmate. He didn't incur a single disciplinary infraction during his 3 years of incarceration. He completed all his programs. He got excellent marks on all of his monthly reports. He completed work assignments. He was, I mean, if you could pick a better inmate, he's one. He's inmate of the year, you know what I mean? And yet, when he came up to his conditional release date, he didn't have a place to go because his family, as supportive as they were, they either resided in public housing or they resided too close to schools. So he wasn't able to get out on his conditional release date. And then he reached his maximum expiration date, and they still didn't let him out. And they actually held him almost 5 months past his maximum expiration date in one of these residential treatment facilities. And this is somebody who is considered a low risk of reoffense. Hmm. And he was essentially held for an additional 5 months in a medium security prison. I personally went to visit him when he was in the, quote, residential treatment facility. And it was no different than visiting any other inmate, in which he had to get permission to come see me. He had to have a pass. He was dressed in an inmate uniform. He had an inmate ID card. I had to get searched. My papers were searched. You know, we sat and met at a table with a CO standing nearby watching us the entire time. So to say that this is residential treatment is a complete misnomer. I mean, it was prison, plain and simple. This is somebody who was substantially restrained in his liberty. He was deprived of the time with his family. Just everything about it was incarceration, and yet no one was really trying to help him change his situation. He's somebody who comes from limited means. What was he supposed to do as an inmate in a medium security prison in terms of finding a place to live? He was relying on the help of the professionals of his guidance counselors and his parole officers to help him find a place to live. And finally, 5 months after his release date, he was released to a shelter where he still is today and where he may be for the next 2.5 years while he finishes his post-release supervision, because there's no place for him to go.
The state is claiming that the people are not actually in prison. The state is claiming that they are in something called a residential treatment facility. And there is certain limited authority under the statutes to allow for at least the first 6 months of a person's parole supervision to be in this so-called residential treatment facility. But in fact, the great majority of these clients are being held in the Fishkill Correctional Facility, which is in fact a prison. The state calls it a residential treatment facility, but a residential treatment facility is defined in state law as a place of transition to the community, a place intended to achieve total reintegration into the community, where the individual under supervision will be able to access housing opportunities, job opportunities, will be able to work so as to reintegrate into the community under supervision. But for all intents and purposes, these clients who are being held in Fishkill Correctional Facility for lack of a residence more than 1,000 feet from a school are still inmates. They eat with other inmates, they wear the uniforms of other inmates, they sleep in the same dormitory conditions as other inmates. They are subjected to all the disciplinary rules that affect other inmates, and some of them, for the most minor violations of prison rules, have been placed in solitary confinement or keep lock in the way that ordinary inmates would be kept. Some of them are allowed to earn $10 a day from prison work as opposed to the $5 a day that ordinary inmates can earn. And they are regularly taken to see parole officers who basically ask them if they have been able to locate compliant residences, but without doing anything to actually help the inmates find residences that comply with this law. So even though the state is claiming that these people are In fact, on post-release supervision in a residential treatment facility, we say that, for all intents and purposes, they are still in prison.
You're listening to the Prison Voices Project on WGXC. I'm your host today, Alexandra Cox. Today's show is about the subject of how we treat sex offenders in the United States. One of the experiences that I had in the last few years was to do an evaluation of an intervention used in British prisons, which was a five-day music project, which we've done a previous show in part about. Last week's show covered this topic on music in prisons. I worked with an organization called the Irene Taylor Trust, and they did five-day intensive music projects in prisons across England and Wales. One of the prisons that we went to was called Her Majesty's Prison, Watton. And this prison was actually entirely made up of people convicted of sex offenses. We worked on a unit of men who were incarcerated primarily for long-term sex offense sentences. And this song that you'll hear next was produced during this five-day unit. What happened during the unit was that the professionally trained musicians would work with the people inside who largely had no to little music experience to produce songs and ultimately a performance. The next song is called Set Me Free and I think is relevant for the topic of today's show.
Take what's on offer, I'll do what I can. I'm asking you to see me might. Just give me a chance to prove that I'm right. Set me free, don't lock me away. I wanna go home, I don't wanna stay. Laugh and smile, I'll put on a grin. I don't need to be locked up again. Put on a grin. I don't need to be locked up again. come on, set me free. Please set me free. Set me free.
That was Set Me Free, a song performed and written by individuals convicted of sex offenses and incarcerated at HMP Watton, a prison in England. The song was produced by the Irene Taylor Trust Music in Prisons organization, which is based in London. The question we're dealing with today is about residency restrictions for sex offenses and a new policy in New York, which is being enforced by the Department of Corrections and Community Services and allows the state to keep people in prison past their maximum expiration date on parole if parole and the individual cannot find themselves a place to live that doesn't meet the residency restriction requirements. The vast majority of the island of Manhattan falls within 1,000 feet of a school zone. That means that anybody attempting to return to Manhattan under this law is forbidden from doing so. So the real question is, are these laws actually effective in preventing sex offenses from occurring? I asked that question of Dr. Jill Levinson, who is an expert on this subject and has done extensive research on residency restrictions, and herself is a practitioner working with individuals convicted of sex offenses.
These laws were passed with good intentions, and they sound good in theory. It sounds like it makes sense. You keep sex offenders from living near places where children tend to be, and, you know, maybe they won't be tempted or they won't have opportunities to abuse kids. And this premise is flawed, actually, for a couple different reasons. One is that all sex offenders are not the same. They're a very heterogeneous group. And so when we use the term sex offender, very often people use it synonymously with words like pedophile or predator, and that simply isn't true. So the term sex offender is a legal term. Pedophilia is a mental disorder that is in the DSM-5, and it means that somebody has a primary or exclusive sexual attraction to prepubescent children. And what we believe from research is that about a third to 40% of registered sex offenders in the United States might meet criteria for a diagnosis of pedophilia. So these laws are passed with the idea that all sex offenders are the same, and all of them have these compulsive, unstoppable, deviant sexual interests toward children. The other flaw in the logic of these laws is that sex offenders don't molest children because they live near schools. They befriend children and their families and engage in relationships in which they can build up trust and familiarity, and that is kind of what allows then what we call grooming, or the beginnings of relationships that can lead to sexual abuse, to take place. So, in other words, it's not the geographical or residential proximity to a school or park that's a risk factor for sex offending. It's the social proximity to children who may trust that person, or when someone is in a position of authority, like a coach or a teacher or a babysitter or a parent or a relative, that is what creates opportunities for abuse. And we know that over 90% of sexually abused children are abused by somebody who they know well and who they and their families trust, and that kids are much more likely to be molested by somebody they know than by some random sex offender who lives within a close proximity to a school.
Attorney Robert Newman talks about what legal challenges and frameworks exist for thinking about this new sex offender restriction policy in New York. Attorney Robert Newman talks about some of the legal challenges that exist to this new policy in New York.
There are a number of individual cases that have been brought in which individual prisoners have sought release on writs of habeas corpus or have sought declaratory judgments. And one judge in Dutchess County ruled that the Fishkill Correctional Facility doesn't actually qualify as a residential treatment facility for the reasons that I gave, and the additional reason that it is far away from New York City, to which most of these prisoners intend to return. The definition of a residential treatment facility under the statute is that it is a facility that is near the community to which the prisoner intends to return. Two judges in Columbia County made similar rulings. And probably as a result of those rulings, the Department of Correctional Services generally stopped using the Hudson Correctional Facility as a residential treatment facility. The rulings are inconsistent, and we are hoping to obtain a more binding legal ruling that what the Department of Correctional Services is doing with these prisoners is contrary to law. We also believe, and this is more of a constitutional issue, that the law is simply irrational. There was a court decision called Matter of Taylor, recently decided by the Supreme Court in California, in which they said that a similar, even more draconian law in California, which resulted in thousands of sex offenders being homeless, violated the due process clause because the law had no rational relationship to its goal of protecting children and teenagers against sexual assault. And it is the unanimous opinion, not just a majority, but a unanimous opinion of experts in the treatment and prevention of sexual abuse, that these residency restrictions have no value in protecting against sexual assault. We have studies from Minnesota and Colorado which say they have no value. We have a policy statement by the Association of for the Treatment of Sexual Abuse that says they have no value. The great majority of sex offenses committed against minors are committed by, against acquaintances or relatives of the offender. They are not committed against, you know, people who are coming to or from school who are being lured or accosted by offenders living nearby. It makes no difference if a person is going to commit a sex offense whether he lives a mile and a half away or a quarter of a mile away from the school.
I asked Jill Levinson about the question that sometimes emerges in my own work, by judges and by prosecutors. Isn't it true that once a sex offender, always a sex offender? Jill spoke about this from the perspective of doing work on the ground with individuals convicted of sex offenses.
I also am a clinical social worker in a sex offender treatment program. Part of the reason that we have laws like this for sex offenders and not so much for other types of criminals is because there is this assumption that once a sex offender, always a sex offender, and they'll never change and they'll always be a high risk to society. So what we know about that is a couple things. One is that the term sex offender is a legal term, not a clinical term. So just like everybody who's arrested for drunk driving is not necessarily an alcoholic, not everybody who is arrested for a sex crime is a person with the disorder of pedophilia or some other paraphilic disorder. So there is an enormous range of different types of behaviors that are considered criminal in a sexual sense, and that can get somebody arrested and landing on a sex offender registry. But not all of those people will meet criteria for pedophilia. But even for those who do, we know that many people with pedophilia actually do not want to be harming children, and they are interested in getting help to help them not act on it. We know that alcoholics and drug addicts can learn to control their behavior. We, you know, sort of have accepted in our society that for some people, not all, but for some people with the disorder of alcoholism, recovery might be a lifelong process. And for some people with the disorder of pedophilia or other types of sexual behavior problems, that may be true, not for all, but for some. And what that means, though, is that we can help people to change the way they think about sex and intimacy and children, and we can help them develop better self-regulatory skills, and we can help them manage and control their behavior moving forward. So is it true that pedophilia can't be cured? Yes. However, it can be managed. People can learn to control their behavior. So just like when we get married, we don't stop being attracted to other people, but hopefully we stop acting on it because we don't want to live outside our value system and we don't want to hurt people we love. And so are we going to cure some people of being attracted to children? No, but we certainly can help them control their behavior and change the way they think. There are some individuals who commit sex crimes who, believe it or not, even though they may know that something is wrong or even if they know that something is wrong or illegal, they may not fully appreciate why something is harmful. And I think this is especially true with young adults and teenage victims who they perceive to be consensually engaging in some sort of relationship. They may technically know about jail bait and know that this behavior is unlawful, but they may not really appreciate or understand why having sex with someone who's so much younger has the potential to be exploitative, or why those teens, even if they want to do this, might be vulnerable to harm. So part of the treatment process is to help build insight and understanding and to help people improve their self-regulation capacities, and also to help people understand the development of their own sexual behavior problems, how they came to be, and how they're going to create more satisfying lives for themselves in the future so that they're less prone to engaging in criminal or harmful or destructive kinds of activities or violence. And of course, part of the problem with all these regulations is that when people don't have a lot of opportunities to create good pro-social and productive, satisfying means of getting their own needs met in their life, and I'm talking about financially, socially, career-wise, then we know that, when people start to feel like there's not much to look forward to in the future, and when we put people in a position of feeling like they have nothing to lose, they're more likely to behave accordingly.
We need to get away, all the way away from registration. You can't know who's going to cause harm. You just cannot. We don't have a way to map out and say this person is going to commit an offense. The only thing we have the ability to do is to place a stigma on people and make it so difficult for them that they cannot live their life, and raise the potential of them committing some other offense to try to make it. And so with organized justice, I believe that by organizing around criminal justice and pairing people up, telling their stories, and removing the mystery of who is that felon or who is that person on the registry, really creates a substantive conversation and begins to change the outlook of multiple people, because they then go and they talk in their groups and they talk at their churches, and all of a sudden you have a more substantive conversation.
And the more that I've worked on this issue, the more upsetting it is to witness the treatment of my clients who are on the sex offender registry. I would never argue that the crimes that they were convicted of were anything but awful, but they have served their time in prison, they've been punished, and they're now trying to rehabilitate themselves, and we have passed many laws that make that nearly impossible. People can... It's very, very hard for my clients to overcome their criminal conviction, to move past it, even if they've shown that they pose no risk of reoffense, even if they've had many years in the community without reoffending, even if they've been evaluated by many experts who say that they don't pose a risk of reoffense, they are constantly haunted by their designation as a sex offender.
You have been listening to the Prison Voices Project, a radio storytelling project highlighting the voices of people impacted by the prison system. The Prison Voices Project airs on the second and fourth Thursday of every month from 10 to 11 a.m. on WGXC Hands-On Community Radio, 90.7 FM in Greene and Columbia counties. If you are listening to the program and would like to share your story, or you have ideas for the program, please write to us at 704 Columbia Street, 2nd floor, Hudson, New York, 12534. If you have feedback about what you have just heard, you can email us at feedback@wgxc.org. Thanks for listening.
I wish I knew how it would feel to be free. I wish I could break all the chains. Oh.